Pleasure to be here. And thank you for the Zoom voice for letting us know that we are recorded now. So it's a big pleasure for me to be here. Thank you for having me. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to share some of the insights and some of their ideas based on the research that I do in relation to the role of social media and digital platforms in the context of the Russia-Ukraine war. First, I should mention that this research is divided in two parts. So I did the research starting from 2017 about the role of social media in the war between Russia and Ukraine, starting from occupation of Crimea. There are some insights that rely on my fieldwork in Ukraine, and on different type of interviews that I did with activists and developers of platforms that take part in different aspects of the conflict and the war. And the second part of the research is something that unfortunately we had to do following the invasion in February on February 24th. And this part of the research is a part of my collaboration with my great colleague from University of Sydney, Dr. Olga Boychuk, and this is still work in progress. And that's why the title of my talk today is Participatory Warfare Revised, because initially I was focusing on trying to map different forms of engagement and try to suggest some concepts that can explain how people participate in conflicts and wars based on different type of digital platforms. But I think that following the start of the current phase of the conflict and war between Russia and Ukraine, there are many things that need to be revised based on what we can see in the last 3 months. And therefore, that's the title of the talk for today. I will skip the abstract, which is just something that you can see on the website. And let me say that, first of all, we can see a lot of different type of efforts of different scholars on the field of security studies, on the field of political science, international relations, sociology, media and communication studies, information system studies, computer science. And this is a long list of disciplines that try to address this reality, that try actually to understand what's different about the nature of modern conflicts because of the role of the digital platforms and digital technologies. If it's about the new domains of the warfare, if it's about the increasing scope of actors that participate in warfare, it's about new means of warfare, or it's about how the warfare is managed. And you can see a plenty of different type of notions and concepts that try to catch and the essence of this change in the nature of modern conflicts. And there are some examples of all these different concepts that you can see here. Just a very recent book by Matthew Ford and Andrew Hoskins, for instance, Radical War, which tries to address this reality as well. But generally, we see an increase in interdisciplinary interest in trying to understand the change in the nature of war. And my talk today is a part of this general effort to try to understand the essence of the change in the nature of the warfare because of the role of information technologies. Now, what I'm trying to do as a part of my research, something that I started doing quite a long time ago, because the first time I started talking about participatory warfare was actually in 2012, based on the analysis of a very different type of conflict, the conflict in the Middle East. But the idea is that we can see the increasing scope of participation of people based on a different type of digital tools. And generally, participation in wars and conflicts is something that we can see over history. So it's not a new thing that we can see different scopes of participation of people beyond people that belong to the organizational frameworks of the traditional militaries. But what is different now is that the tools that construct the picture of the conflict, the tools of symbolic construction of the conflict, the social media and the different type of digital platforms, and tools of participation that allow to engage in response, what you can see there, are the same tools. So this is the different thing. You can see something that is related to war, and then you can immediately engage based on the same tool. So you hold your mobile phone in your hands, you read something about the war conflict, And then with several clicks, you can do something about it. So this is a new reality. This is something that we haven't seen before, that the same tool is responsible for the symbolic construction of a remote event of war. And the same tool is also able to give you a range of affordances how to participate and respond to what you see. And that's why when we think about participatory warfare, we try to think about the new forms of participation on based on these tools and how these new forms of participation and how the new forms of mediation of relationship between the digital users and conflicts increase the scope of participation and the scope of number of people that can participate, but also increase the forms of participation. And this is something that I tried to map as a part of my research project that I started in 2017 about the participatory warfare in the Russia-Ukraine war. And I was able to map quite a lot of different type of examples. It's also important to distinguish maybe the notion of participatory warfare, which was offered by Merin in his book Digital War, because there the participation is mainly related to the information aspects of participation. So it's about symbolic participation, generation of content, sharing, and maybe some forms of information warfare. But what we can see in participatory warfare is a much bigger scope of participation that includes a lot of offline activities, and we will come back to some of the examples. But the idea is, again, that we see the increasingly rapid development of the scope of participation. And this is something that we'll see based on some empirical examples today as well. To address some additional theoretical aspects, it's also important to link between the notion of this participatory warfare to the notion of digital sourcing, because any type of participation in general relies on the mobilization of our resources. So if we share something, if we generate content, if we do something about the war, if it's still something that requires either our cognitive resources or it's our symbolic resources, social resources, our physical resources, but the relationship between the users, the digital crowd and wars is can be described as a relationship of digital mediation of mobilization of resources. And that's why the notion of crowdsourcing is quite fruitful as a broad concept to address how digitally mediated mobilization of resources can be seen as a dominant form of relationship between the users and the wars, the conflicts, and how the digital mediation offers different opportunities to mobilize these resources. Now, the last conceptual note to make about the nature of this participation should rely on a concept that many of you are probably familiar with, and this is the concept of the connective action that was developed by Alexander Segerberg and Lance Bennett. And this concept is important because what we can see in participatory warfare, that we see more and more forms of participation without any affiliation with any organizational frameworks. Because as we know from the concept of connective action, digital media can be considered as an organizing agent. And here we can see how digital media serves as the organizing agent of participation in war. And then you don't really need to have any type of formal affiliation with any type of organizational structure. That might change, and this is something that we are going to address, but initially the starting point of many forms of participation is something that you do without having any affiliation. Now, when I was preparing for this seminar, I was looking onto the website and the framework of the seminars, and I found something which is really resonates with what I'm trying to do as a part of this talk today when I try to revise and think what is different about participation that we can see during the last 3 months. And this is something that I could see in the description of your approach to the notion of digital ecosystems as the dominant framework and the unit of analysis, as something that may potentially describe the complex form of relationship between different type of actors, and something that may potentially also think about alternative forms of relationship that are hidden, concealed, because this is not a part of the visible reality that surrounds us, but we still need to consider it as well. So my approach is quite similar, I think, because I'm trying to think about war as a digital ecosystem. And you will see that the major framework for the empirical analysis that I'm going to present today tries to build on this idea of war as digital ecosystem and then try to understand the properties of this ecosystem and maybe see how different parts of this ecosystem have different type of properties. And that's actually something that you can see in the next slide, which describes my conceptual framework. And the idea is that when I look into the current war, so what I'm trying to investigate is the following triangles. So you have, first of all, the users and the way digital mediation, digital platforms mediate the relationship between the users and the war. And then you have different scope of participation, which can be take different forms, if it's a symbolic participation, or if it's a different form of activity in relation to conflict. And also the same tools that I use to participate are also involved in the symbolic construction of conflict as well. So you have the conflict as an object of participation, which is constructed based on the tools. And then the same tools offer an opportunity to address this conflict, which is an outcome of this symbolic construction. So these things are interrelated. At the same time, as a part of the same triangle, you also have the relationship between the users and the different type of institutional structures. So it's about security system, local authorities, the government, because as we know, in the context of wars, traditionally, the control over the means of violence and participation in war was always an extremely sensitive issue for institutional actors. So what we need to investigate with a focus on digital mediation is on the one hand, what kind of scope of participation we can see, and on the other hand, to what extent the scope of participation is controlled or managed or facilitated in the context of the relationship between the users and the institutional actors. And what I can see is a very interesting development of from independent forms of participation to more synergy in some cases or more control in some other cases from institutional actors or the form of participation by the users. So if we look into this picture, we can, for instance, apply this picture to this model to the current war between Russia and Ukraine. So if you imagine that you can see the Ukraine on the left side and the Russia on the right side, you may consider, first of all, how the scope of participation of users in the war is different on the Russian side and on the Ukrainian side. And the second thing, to what extent the structure of the relationship between the users and the governments is different. Obviously, my argument today will be that this is extremely different type of structure of relationship. And if we need to understand the forms of participatory warfare, we need to look into the structure of the relationship between the governments and the users. And because this relationship is completely different on the Ukrainian side and the Russian side, we can see very different scope of participation based on digital tools. And we can see also very different outcomes for the scope of this participation as well. And this is just kind of framework to examine the digital ecosystem that we can see around the war. Now, as I mentioned, I'm doing the research about it for last several years. And initially, I was interested in some specific aspects that I would like to mention briefly, because this is something that builds the foundation for the current discussion. One thing that I was looking into as a part of this digital ecosystem is how warfare, because of new forms of participation, become a part of our everyday life. And what are the outcomes of this trend of increasing presence of war in our everyday life? And this is something that I try to address as domestication of warfare when I try to explore how actually the war become, because of the digital mediation, become a part of our domestic environment. I published an article which addressed the kind of this phenomenon of something that we may call sofa warfare. In Russian, it's called divanny vojska, of how people participate in war from the comfort of their bedrooms and dining rooms, and what that means actually for the forms of participation. And again, the question is to what extent this participation can be seen in the context of the relationship with institutional actors and what the forms of participation, because on the Russian side, this participation has mainly symbolic nature. On the Ukrainian side, we can see how this participation goes from online participation to offline one. Again, in the Russia, on the Russian side, you can see a protest that took place just several weeks ago when an activist in one of the towns of Russia actually went to the square and burned the sofa and wrote zlo, which is evil in Russian. And it starts with the Z, which is now the symbol of the Russian invasion. Because this participation is linked to different forms of propaganda, different forms of information warfare, or different forms of slacktivism in the context of the war. So the idea is that this kind of sofa really represents the evil of the military aggression. On the Ukrainian side, we can see that the conflict is not really domesticated. It goes out of the domestic space. And again, the difference that we can see in the location of the conflict in everyday life is something that we may potentially explain based on the model that I presented and the different forms of relationship between institutional actors and the users.
Am I the only one who can't hear Gregory anymore?
I'm sorry, if you
can. Okay, yeah, now it's good.
Okay. Anyone else cannot hear me, please?
It was just the last five seconds and now it's fine again. I guess it was some button. Thanks.
Yeah. We always can expect some interference from those who are interested in this talk, from maybe the Russian side. But hopefully no hackers and no software warriors here. So back to some outcomes of my empirical work in Ukraine, I just would like to make a couple of quotes from some of the interviews, which described this relationship between institutional actors and the users that rely on digital platforms in order to participate. So for instance, one of the people that I interviewed, who is an activist in one of the cities, explained that army can be considered as organizational structure and volunteering is something that can be considered as a function. And the shape of volunteering is a function driven. And that's why when the army as a structure is not flexible enough and is not able actually to fulfill some functions, so the volunteers just fill that gap. So that's an interesting way to describe the relationship between institutional actors and the users. Another argument was that the civil society in Ukraine is extremely strong and it drives forward everyone else, and it is able to replace a weak state at some point of time. At least this is part of the narrative. Again, this is not my argument, but the idea is that if we think about forms of digital participation, we need to look into the way the narratives of the state, the way the perception of state can be seen based on how volunteers and users that participate in the war think about it. So it's all about the difference in the nature of these horizontal networks of civic resilience, and it's all about to what extent there is an opportunities for horizontal interaction between the military and the people and how they actually close. And again, if you consider both sides of the conflicts, obviously there are huge differences in these type of relationships. And what I also could see that actually there was a very big transformation in the nature of relationship between the users and the state in the last 5 years, because initially we could see that most of the participation was a connective war participation. It had no organizational affiliation. It relied on media as organizing agent. It was different forms of crowdsourcing when people just used their resources based on Facebook groups. And here I refer to the case of air reconnaissance, which is using drones for the collection of intelligence. When people who just amateurs who know how to use drones started to use some of their personal drones to support military. Then at some point of time, some of these people started to self-organize and create institutional structures. And some of the structures created centers that offer training for military. So this is a shift from crowdsourcing to outsourcing, because here already you could see that these people started actually offering services, and the relationship was based on some organizational affiliation between the security system and some independent organizational units. And then some of these people actually went into the military and created some of the units within the security system, including this unit that is responsible for drones. So here we can see a transformation from outsourcing to insourcing. And again, that's an interesting transformation, because this is the change in the nature of relationship between the users and the state based on a transformation of crowdsourcing to outsourcing to insource. So just to conclude this part, and I will move now for the research that relies on the last 3 months since the invasion of February. What we actually can see is also very interesting link between the perception of people regarding the role of the state and the forms of participation. Because what I was able to identify that if there is a threat, that the threat is an object of potential activity, the war, something that comes from outside, if people think that the Russians are coming, there is a perception that if you are not going to participate, the risk to your life is higher than you are not going to participate because the state is not there. Then, if the institutional actors at the same time, the military, the government are portrayed as someone who is not able to defend you, you may potentially see a very kind of large scope of mobilization. So the idea that this threat is high, the risk of non-participation is high, the institutional actors are not able to protect you based on your perception. And also you're not able to join the military, because what we could see at the beginning of the war in 2014, that the traditional forms of mobilization, which are called the Voyenkomats in Ukraine and Russia as well, so all these places where you go if you want to mobilize, were not really working. So digital platforms were actually the only way for people to mobilize in relation to conflict, because the traditional channels of mobilization didn't work. So these three factors, the perception of threat, the perception of the role of the state, and the perception of the affordances of how you actually can respond to the threat, is something that interrelated, and this is something that can be helpful to explain the scope of participation. Now, obviously, when we are 8 years later, after the beginning of this war, we can see that the narratives has changed. The risk and the existential threat is still very high, but the perception of institutional actors is different, because we can see how the Ukrainian military and state gradually build some capabilities, including offering some new frameworks to mobilize people as a part of this kind of regional city-based defense framework. And also this is something that offering new affordances of mobilization that are not necessarily rely on digital platforms. So that's something that may change and explain the change in the scope of participation and the forms of mobilization. And also we can see that this increasing role of state is something that contributes to shift from and transition from crowdsourcing to more insourcing and outsourcing, so to less connective or more and more collective action as a part of response to the threat as well. Now, based on this framework, in the next 15 minutes, 20 minutes, I would like to discuss some more recent empirical examples, and actually to argue that we need to revise our view of participatory warfare, because it has to be seen in the context of the general ecosystem. We cannot think about participatory warfare just as increasing the scope of mobilization, because this participation should be seen as a part of the property of the ecosystem. And therefore, we need to consider overall framework. So, first question that we may want to ask in order to understand what's happening over the last 3 months, if the current war is the most transparent war we have ever seen. And this is an open question. I don't have any answer to it. But we may argue that the amount of data and real time data and information that we get about this war is something that we haven't seen in any conflict before. One may argue that actually this is also creates information overload and creates more opportunities for disinformation and fakes. So having more data in real life, in real time, doesn't really mean that we are more informed about the war. And we also can see that some atrocities and the violation of very basic human rights, something that we have seen in Bucha, still wasn't really prevented despite this increasing level of transparency. But this is an argument that we still need to consider, because again, the construction of the war is something that is related to the way we respond to the war. So if this war is a war which is most transparent, or at least that it generates a huge amount of data and information, then the participation should be seen in the context of what we can see about the war. So that's the first thing that we need to consider, and it's an open question. And then we can see some specific cases of platforms that take a very different type of shape in this war. Because, for instance, when we see the Telegram, which is a special case because it still hasn't been banned in Russia as well, so it's available in Russia, we can see a lot of cases of innovation based on Telegram. Because on the one hand, Telegram is a source of continuous stream of information, and there are different channels and chats and groups there that represent the Ukrainian sources and the Russian sources as well. But on the other hand, Telegram is also something that's used for mobilization. There are many chatbots. And again, I will give you some examples a little bit later that engage people in participation in different types of activities. So Telegram is a very open tool, which can be considered both as a source of information, but also the something that mediates different forms of participation. Finally, what is really important is the availability of the internet in general, because we can see with the Russian invasion, and some of you have a better knowledge than me about how we can see the change in the infrastructural access to the internet networks, but having the capacity to get an access is crucial in order to continue to be engaged based on some of the digital tools. And when we could see, for instance, what happened in Mariupol around the Azovstal factory and the Azov battalion that was located there, that the soldiers were able to continue to communicate in extremely challenging situation of complete blockade, and they were still able to at least participate in the construction of the conflict as an object, and also to have a direct communication because of, for instance, the affordances of satellite internet as well. And there is a very interesting exchange that you could see on Twitter between the representative of the Ukrainian government, Mikhail Fedorov, and Elon Musk, and actually, and we could see that Musk did a lot of special efforts to make Starlink stations available for the people in Ukraine because of the importance of prioritization of access to those who participate in war. So this availability is, again, something that needs to be considered, because this is something that potentially increase the potential role of the digital tools for offering a broad range of potential forms of participation in war. Some of the examples, again, related to the role of the satellite internet, but I will skip it because I already mentioned it. And finally, the role of hyperlocal chats. Again, as based on Telegram, based on WhatsApp, based on different type of tools, we could see self-organization of people based on existing hyperlocal chats already. And these chats are very open. They can be used for very, very different type of things, for collection of intelligence. So people share if they see soldiers from their windows. They share very tragic and terrible news about atrocities that I just mentioned. They try to facilitate mutual aid. They try to facilitate some forms of resistance, maybe. So they try to share some information that can be used as intelligence for the military forces. A lot of different forms of potential functions of these chats in the context of the war. Now, in order to make sense of all those of these things, it's not enough to just focus on the mediation as something that can explain the increase in scope of participation. So that's why when we see this type of examples, as for instance, the case of hyperlocal chats or Telegram, we need to think about the generativity as the major feature of participatory warfare. And some of you may know and be familiar with this concept by that was introduced initially by Jonathan Zittrain from Burton Center in 2006. And the idea is that generativity is something that describes the system's capacity to produce an anticipated change, and that some of the tools that are created, we never really know how these tools can be used. And what we can see now is the increase in generativity of tools. And then the question that we need to ask, if the digital ecosystem allows different forms of generativity, and why some parts of the system are more open for generativity and some other parts of systems are less open for generativity, because it seems that going beyond the anticipated forms of participation is something that we can see a lot as a part of the empirical cases. And then in order to think about how the system is structured, the second concept that I rely on is taken from the management literature, and this is the concept of open innovation. And the idea is that as a part of open innovation, we can see this kind of the company and the external environment, or maybe the institutional actors and the crowd. And then we need to focus on the structure of the relationship between these two, on the flows that go from inside out and from outside in. And we need to ask the question, to what extent the structure of the digital system around this world is really something that can be described in terms of open innovation, to what extent it allows the flows of innovation from institutional actors to the crowd and from the crowd to institutional actors, or it's a vertical system which doesn't really allow this type of flows. And then looking into the different aspects of the system, you may potentially explain why the degrees of generativity and the scope of participation in conflict can be seen in different scales in different sides of the conflict. Now, based on that, we tried to develop a methodological framework for mapping all the forms of participation that we were able to identify during the last 3 months. And again, here I'm presenting a part of the work that was conducted and is still work in progress with my colleague, Dr. Olga Boychuk from University of Sydney. And here we can see that we tried to map the generativity of the tools based on two aspects. One, to what extent these tools enable open or closed participation, if anyone is able to participate, how big are the potential crowds of users that can use these tools to participate, or this is something that requires some kind of specific expertise, or it's available to people only in specific location, and then the participation is relatively closed. And the second, if the participation is defensive, it's more about mutual aid, it's more about assistance to the people on the local level, it's about protection in face of the threat, or it's offensive participation, which targets the threat, which is more about involvement of people to address the threat and something that helps actually to go against the threat and against the invader. So, here I'm going just to mention several examples. I'm going to do it quite fast. Some of these examples are familiar, because what is mainly important for me is to present the outcome of this mapping exercise. So some of the forms of participation are still related to the symbolic participation, which is about the construction of the war as an object. And for instance, the wars around the Wikipedia chapter of Russian invasion of Ukraine 2022 is something that may present this type of framing war around the construction of the war as an object. There are many different types of tools that we have seen that used to spot and monitor a movement of Russian billionaires or the Russian agents of state. So something that helps actually to implement the sanctions and engage people in some aspects of the management of the conflict as well, which related to implementation of the sanctions and increasing transparency around what the Russian side does. There are many things that we also have seen previously in other conflicts, but this is also a part of the trend now, which is related to either identifying munitions and to what extent this munition is legal to use, or mapping the vehicles, which was particularly crucial during the first phase of the conflict when it was not really clear what are the intentions of the Russian side regarding the start of this conflict as well. So open source intelligence community, or open source investigator community, because sometimes they don't really like when we call them intelligence. So they are still present here as well. And this is a part of a scope of participation. Some more defensive forms of participation, which are related to mutual aid, crowdsourcing of help for refugees, housing, different type of humanitarian assistance. There are dozens of different type of projects that address these things. And this is also a part of the scope of participation that we can see around the world. Now, some interesting cases of hacktivism, for instance, related to personal data leaks. When first there are leaks of personal data of soldiers in Russia and Belarus, but then special chatbots were created that actually offer the users to call some of these people, because it gives you some random phone from this database, and you can call this person and say that you should not participate in war. So it's a part of engagement of people in psychological warfare based on hacktivist activities and personal data leaks. And again, as I mentioned, Telegram gives you a very generative environment to generate a lot of different type of tools. Now, a lot of different cases related to cyber warfare. If it's about cyber protection, which is a mobilization of different type of experts, how to protect Ukrainian infrastructure, or it's actually about cyber offensive, because the same Mikhail Fedorov Mikhailo Fedorov, who was also participating in this discussion with Elon Musk. He also was the one who published an open call to join the cyber front for different type of hackers in order to target and attack Russian digital targets. And again, there was a special chatbot created in order to facilitate this participation as well. One of my favorite examples is actually creation of a game that was called the Play for Ukraine, which actually by playing the game, you are participating in DDoS attack against Russian targets. And here, this game actually opened for even children for participation. So when we think about open and offensive participation in conflict, I think this game gives you a very good illustration of how offensive open participation may look like, because here the scope of participation does not require any skills, any knowledge, and it's open for any age groups, though obviously that raised some ethical questions about participation as well. Now, there is a lot of interesting discussion about crowdsourcing of information for artillery attacks. There was an interesting case, which is not really clear if it's linked to Russian side or not, when a platform was used, a platform that was called Premise. It's a crowdsourcing platform that is based in the US, seemed to be used actually to collect data about physical objects and targets on Ukrainian territory. People got some micro tasks to do it. And there is a suspicion that it was facilitated by Russian side. There is no confirmation, but generally, again, that presents a case of how actually verification of targets can be done based on crowdsourcing and as a form of participation, which is also very offensive form of participation as well, because it's eventually leads to attacking these places. Many cases of crowdfunding, again, there can be topic for separate presentation, but what is interesting now that we can see a lot of crowdfunding based on cryptocurrency and NFTs, so all these trends, which is a whole separate world, which I'm not going to touch today, but also crowdfunding, which is directed to specific people who would like to join the conflict. So some of people from Canada or from Europe who would like actually to go and fight for Ukraine, crowdfunded money in order to support their journey to join this fight. And finally, a couple of last cases before I present the outcomes, different forms of facilitation of civilian resistance, sharing information, how to prepare Molotov cocktails, how to attack Russian vehicles, TikTok movies about preparation of Molotov cocktails, different forms of instruction. So the facilitation of sharing of knowledge can be also seen as a part of facilitation of and supporting different forms of offline action as well. So here we come with a typology of crowdsourcing, and again, the list can be longer. I presented some of these, but what is really important is try to think about it in terms of generativity based on what I mentioned as openness with closeness and the defensive and offensive forms of participation. And here we came with actually this type of result, which represents a very interesting trend. That actually we see some kind of shift from more closed to more open participation and from more defensive to more offensive participation, which is a very interesting trend based on this kind of notion of generativity of tools, because we see that the tools offer a lot of potential forms of innovation of how you can mediate relationship between users and conflicts and wars and how the resources can be mobilized. But the trend that we can see in last 3 months, again, based on our analysis, and this is still work in progress, the trend is that we can see a shift from defensive to offensive forms of participation and a trend from a closed to more open forms of participation. And when we think again about this kind of games as Play for Ukraine, so this is offensive. So someone should probably mute yourself. I'm sorry, just to avoid echo. This is just some initial outcomes of our mapping. Obviously, that trend raised some legal questions about what are the responsibilities of people who participate in offensive forms. And this is again a topic for separate presentation, but what is interesting to do is to apply this notion of direct participation, what can be considered as direct participation from legal point of view. And as some of you may know, from legal point of view, if you are able to identify the chain between the specific form participation, so direct causation between something that you do and the harm and the outcome which leads to killing someone, then that can be potentially considered as direct participation. So it's not about just a fact of participation, it's also about this causality that should be identified in order to establish legal responsibility. I just mentioned it because I often get questions about it, but that's a separate topic for discussion as well. So here I come to conclusion of my presentation for today and why I think that we need to revise the notion of participatory warfare and look into this notion in the context of the structure of the digital ecosystems. So when we look into the Ukrainian side, so imagine that this is the left side of this image, we can see a very big scale of generativity regarding the scope of participation. We can see a lot of innovation, and we can see a lot of flows of innovation between the institutional actors and the citizens, which to some extent reminds us about what can be described as a form of open innovation. So the way the Ukrainian side managed war is something that can be described not only as a participatory war, but what is mostly important is it's an open war, because it can be seen as an ecosystem of open innovation, which is open to this inside out and outside inflows of innovation between institutional actors and the citizens, and different forms of institutionalization of participation of citizens, users, in the conflict that can be seen as a form of not only crowdsourcing, but also outsourcing and insourcing. When we look into the Russian side, we can see a very traditional vertical system of control, which cannot really be described as an open innovation system. It's a closed system, which may have some innovation and some engagement, but the state really tries to control the scope of participation of people to staying at home, staying on sofa, doing this kind of sofa warfare, which is mainly related to symbolic participation and maybe participation in participatory propaganda, sharing some images, images or sharing some content about war, but not really participating in the war. So the military system is completely disconnected from this citizen participation system. The state is really concerned about the controlling forms of participation. So the scope of participation for the users is very, very limited, is mainly related to symbolic participation, is also under the state's control. So when we have a clash between the open war and closed war systems, this is something that may potentially also explain this kind of strategic surprise the resilience of the Ukrainian side, because we can see, when we see these opportunities for generativity, when we see a lot of innovation, this is something that compensates maybe for the lack of the traditional forms of power, because you are able to adapt fast, you are able to address the threat in a very flexible way, and you're able to develop flexible forms of synergy depending on the nature of the threat. When you have a closed system, your resilience is limited, your flexibility is limited, you just rely on the traditional forms of power. So looking into this digital ecosystem as a clash of open war with closed war, when on the one hand we have a great scale of generativity, an increasing scope of participation, and also the structure of relationship that can be described as open innovation, and the lack of generativity and the closed vertical system on the other side, this is something that I think is essential and important in order to understand how this conflict, this war is going on for the last 3 months. And I think also this is something that can explain why we can see on the Ukrainian side this trend of generativity that increasingly open and increasingly offensive because of the nature of the threat. And obviously there is no any dynamic change about participation on the Russian side, which remains quite limited. But the presentation today was mainly focused on the Ukrainian side. So these are just some links of my recent publications, and I'm happy to come back to it and share it later, but I'll stay with this slide, or maybe I'll stop sharing in order to open the floor to the questions. And thanks again for listening to me for the last 45 minutes.
Thanks, Gregory. I don't know if we should open the microphone here so that you can.
Can anyone online confirm whether you hear me well? On 1, 2, 3.
Yes, very well.
Great. Thanks, Gregory. This was very intense and a lot of different fields that can themselves become a dedicated topic for a paper. Very intense fieldwork also. I have a few observations, but also some questions. So I'm interested in the comparison between the army organization and the communication organization, because you also mentioned it somewhere, but you didn't develop it. The nature of Ukrainian and Russian armies and their organization and their culture. I'm reading several Telegram channels that are dedicated to an analysis of Ukrainian war, one of which is run by Igal Levin, who is a specialist in history of conflicts, and he is describing Ukrainian army as decentralized, where decisions are made on a very, very low level. It means that even small like unit commanders or just soldiers can take initiative, propose something. So the army itself is kind of generative. And in your scheme, it's a triangle that is larger next to the citizen side and goes to the top of the military that doesn't have actually to approve all of these small decisions that are taken locally. And the Russian army is described like this vertical, very slow machine where everything is done from the top. So this somehow reflects your discourse when we look at the open versus closed war. So this is quite interesting. And I also wonder if this nature of Ukrainian army and Ukrainian society and form of participation is connected to the government, to the government itself, and to the state itself, which is I won't call it weaker because I don't know what's the strength here, but it doesn't have all the things covered. There are some spaces where state doesn't feel everything, and Ukrainian society seems to kind of fit in this lacunes and fill them with citizen innovation. And it was like that already in 2014 during Maidan, and many things back then were institutionalized that were born on the streets. So this is something interesting. And for example, the drones, I know it because I was helping some people with drones in Ukraine, connecting them to some other people who knew a little bit more about how drones function. And indeed, this is a very, very good example of where the state doesn't have its own like professional kind of drone unit, doesn't have yet. So on the very first days of the war, amateurs play this very big role, and now the international community seems to also help. And Ukrainian army is now technically even more advanced than Russian on many levels. But I think that they have become so advanced also thanks to this generative nature and of all these petitions like buy me the fighter jet and so on. I wonder, so some of my questions that I have prepared. First, I wonder if your model can also work to describe the anti-war protests, because your model, when you describe Russia, doesn't work for Russian anti-war movement. Russian protests against the war are more kind of copying Ukrainian generative model. They are very innovative in their scope, and they are very kind of sometimes even very offensive, because we see sabotage on the rails and these actions across all Russia that happen every other day are silenced. That's maybe the difference between the anti-war protest movement and the pro-war fake movement, which is interesting because the government tries to pretend that there is a crowdsourced movement that supports the war, and they use offline measures to stage this support. I don't know if you've seen that as well. This is quite curious because a Russian state would use offline modes to engage people in the Venkomat, in the circumscription offices. They would put inflatable mayor, like, I don't know if you've seen that, that was quite a scandal. They put this inflatable army person, like big, like Michelin guy, a balloon next to Venkamat, like appealing people to join the army with some music playing that looked completely out of, like, displaced, like out of the kind of contrasting with the nature of communications. And they were also using forced circumscription, taking people from their houses or from the university. And they were also using, like, children's bodies to draw these Z letters. And all of this is done offline and versus, like, online. Initially online activities of Ukrainian supporters. So so my question is, does your model, can your model help explain this anti-war protest and how? If yes, also a little bit on your methodology, how do you select, how did you select people for your interviews? Were those like exploratory interviews with some opinion leaders across Ukrainian bloggers or online influencers? Or what was the audience that you approached? And what are your next steps in terms of data collection? Do you see any quantitative ways to deal with this? Because you have a bunch of various data sources. What are your next steps, methodologically speaking? Thank you.
Okay, thanks. That's a lot of points. I made
just
some
discussions, kind of, yes. Comment and two questions.
Yes, I made some notes. So first, you started from talking about the decentralized nature of the military, which is something that we can see in many militaries now. The idea is that to give more independence to the unions. I think what is mostly interesting in the case of Ukraine is not only the structure of the military, but the structure of the relationship between the civil society and the military. Because what I could see in my research as a part of field work is a lot of horizontal bottom-up connections on the local level between the specific battalion, the specific unit, and the people around. So the openness of the military to collaborate with external actors, if it's about just logistical support, if it's about something else as well, if it's about crowdfunding that actually was directed by some units when the officers were calling to the managers of crowdfunding platforms and say, okay, I need that. Can you help me to crowdfund it from your platform? So this type of collaboration, which also obviously creates some additional problems as well, which have been raised by many interviews, that how you avoid some corruption around this type of things. But obviously this is less important during such an intensive phase of war like now. But these horizontal connections, and also the fact that people are very mobile. So people join the military for several months, people leave the military. So the nature of this horizontal connections is also because of the nature of the relationship. So I definitely agree that this decentralized nature is very important. When on the Russian side, we have seen even rumors. Again, it's rumors. It's we don't really need to confirm it. But even the fact that these rumors exist, that Russian president participates in making the tactical decisions, which is the total opposite, which is really kind of the symbolic manifestation of the vertical nature of the system. That's one thing. When we think about the Ukrainian leaders, they mostly operate like digital influencers. They mobilize networks, they inspire networks, they serve as catalysts, something that we know as a form of leadership in the network environment. So when you see such a big network of leaders as a catalyst that do not give a specific orders, but just inspire networks to mobilize by sharing some vision. So this is a very different type of leadership as well, which again, for instance, can be seen in Telegram, because obviously there are some Russian leaders, like we had a discussion yesterday about Medvedev and how he used Telegram, but we also have Zelensky. So when you compare the Zelensky channel on Telegram and Medvedev channel on Telegram, you will obviously see some very principal differences between these channels. Now, it is important, you mentioned the link between Maidan, for instance, and the war. So Maidan was a space of generativity. Maidan was a space of innovation. We have seen that people actually were physically living from Maidan to war in 2014, but also a lot of innovation and platforms, including drones that were using to create the symbolic images of Maidan. The activists from Maidan that used the drones actually started to use the drones during the war. So there is a transition. There are the networks that mobilize around internal political crises, then move and start operating around external crises. So that's an important aspect as well. But the main message of my presentation is that generativity cannot flourish without this openness of the ecosystem. So if you have a system that is open for open innovation, then you can see the increasing role of generativity of the tools and platforms. And if there is no this type of openness, so there is no space for generativity. Now, in relation to your question about anti-war protest. So on the one hand, you actually can see anti-war protest as the proxy or extension of the Ukrainian side to some extent. So you may potentially consider it as a part of this kind of extension of the generative and open system of the Ukrainian side. At the same time, I personally think it's extremely interesting. I haven't done any research about that. So I think that you indicate here something which is very important to explore. I think that this is a very interesting topic, because again, you can see a clash between this kind of openness and you mentioned a vertical traditional model of mobilization that's related to Voyenkomat. And again, obviously, when you compare the mobilization on the Ukrainian side and Russian side, that looks very different. And the affordances of mobilization look very different as well. Finally, the methodological question. So the interviews that I did for the first phase of my project were mainly addressed to different either founders of crowdsourcing and crowdfunding platforms or moderators of different type of Facebook groups that facilitated logistical support, medical support, drones, engagement. So all the people that can be seen as activists that or innovators on the central level, but also on the regional level as well. Because you could, as I mentioned, that was a lot of local networks. For instance, Dnipro was a very important strategic point between the Ukraine and the eastern part where the threat could come from. So people at Dnipro were preparing in starting from 2014. And that's where you could see a lot of this development of this local networks as well. So that was a kind of a snowball interviews starting from some activists that use social media to facilitate different type of Facebook groups that used to support different military efforts. So that was the main target audience for my interviews, to understand their narratives about what they think about the state, what actually activated them, how they perceived the state and how their perception of the state changed, and how their forms of mobilization changed in the context of the change of the perception of threat and the perception of the role of the state. And that's what also allowed to identify this shift from crowdsourcing to insourcing to outsourcing to insourcing in the context of the change of the perception of state. Now, the second aspect of methodological framework is really trying to collect as many as possible instances and examples of innovation, and then try to map it based on mainly desk research, which is related to mapping different forms of innovation and trying to also communicate with different activists and users that may share additional examples. So if you know any interesting examples that I should consider, please let me know as well. So here, the methodological focus is really about the collection of the examples of innovation in order to map the scope of participation and then link this scope of participation to the structure of relationship between the users and institutional actors. That's the end of my response. I can see some additional questions in the chat. You can help me to facilitate.
Sure. Thank you very much, Gregory. So indeed, I will relay one particular question of Geronimo, who asks a very important one, but is in a library, so I relay it live for him. So he asks, if do you see a link between participatory warfare and democracy, and whether participatory warfare is a new kind of democratic warfare?
I think it's a very interesting and big question, because it really depends on how you define democracy. I think that generally the culture of participation is something that we can see in democratic political systems. So the democracy is something that potentially offer more opportunities for horizontal connections, offer more space for open innovation and more space for generativity. But then we need really to operationalize and understand specifically what we mean by democracy, what kind of democracy. I think also the leaders from democratic societies can be seen more involved as someone who inspire networks and communicate with networks directly and not just manage the things in the vertical way as well. Societies. So that's another aspect when societies we can see potentially more forms of synergy between institutional actors and the citizens, and in autocratic societies with the main kind of framework of thinking about the networks is how to control these networks. So obviously if it's about control and not about engagement, then there is less space for generativity and there is less space for openness. Personally, I also did some research regarding something that they call vertical crowdsourcing. And the idea is that there are some forms of crowdsourcing, but these forms of crowdsourcing are mainly focused on how to control the crowds and not how to engage them, when the engagement is just a fake structure, a fake framework that is used in order to actually control the crowds. So that's why the traditional open crowdsourcing can be seen in democratic societies, but the vertical form of crowdsourcing that is driven by this mode of thinking about control, mindset of control, is something that can be seen in autocratic environments.
Many thanks. I think that maybe Françoise, do you want to ask your question directly?
Yes, maybe. Thank you so much, Grigory, for your presentation. And I was absolutely very interested in what you said about participatory warfare in Ukraine. But I was thinking about the Russian side, the Russian case. And I'm a little bit more skeptical about your consideration regarding the Russian side and what you said, which was something like a top-down model of control. And I was wondering if we can speak about participatory authoritarianism in the Russian case, because where some people, where some ordinary citizens, loyal citizens, also participate in control and surveillance of the population, both online and offline. And I was thinking about vigilantism, for example, or about what was in the past, the Druzhiniki movement. And it was in order to discuss this top-down model and try to complexify maybe the situation regarding the Russian side.
I think I completely agree with you that what we can see is this kind of participatory authoritarianism, or I just mentioned vertical crowdsourcing, which is kind of another way to describe this participatory authoritarianism, because the idea is how you use participation in a controlled way in order to achieve your political goals in the context of the autocratic society. But in my opinion, this participatory authoritarianism means that you control the scope of participation. You have a very specific narrow vision of how participation should look like in order to be under control and fulfill your political goals, but you do not give this participation the space for generativity. You do not release control in order to make possible unexpected forms of innovation around participation. And this is something that cannot happen in participatory authoritarianism, because it's all about this very narrow frameworks that are shaped in a vertical way by the state. So I think I share your vision of that. If you see that there is some kind of disagreements between what I say and the way you see it, if you can maybe communicate it, because it will be easy for me to address it, because from what you said, I think it's quite similar to what I think about it as well.
Thank you very much, Grigory. I think that Timofey had a hand raised. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. I have just a tiny remark, maybe as an extension of Françoise Dosset's question. Just speaking of this top-down state control participatory model that you have mentioned, and speaking about the structure of vertical relations on the Russian side, you have tried to map the examples of innovative and open mobilization efforts on the Ukrainian side. But then we have this interesting example, I think, of Strelkov Girkin, who is the informal ideological leader of the Russian invasion in Ukraine since 2014, who is very well known for outwardly criticizing the Russian Russian president and the Russian minister of defense for being incompetent and for lacking resources to maintain this invasion. And he's been actually, I've seen his I'm following his Telegram channel, and he's been organizing crowdsourcing campaigns to obtain munitions for the Russian forces. So it probably would be interesting to map also these not state controlled but top down grassroots controlled efforts to in this respect.
Thank you, Timofey, for mentioning it. If we recall, actually, when the invasion started in 2014, it was actually titled by the Strelkov people as the Russian Spring, which tries to replicate this idea of the Arab Spring, of the spirit of the mobilization of people for the just cause. We actually could see different forms of crowdfunding, mainly based on different platforms, starting from 2014. At the same time, it looks like that the Russian state was always very concerned about these things going out of control. So here, it's not a part of something that is sponsored or are supported by state, but maybe something that can be considered as the potential threat by state actors. And as you mentioned, also Girkin is considered to be as quite problematic oppositional figure, not oppositional in the democratic way, but maybe oppositional from the other side of the spectrum. I think this type of things continue. There are also some examples of the mobilization of people to support soldiers, etc. So definitely there is more space to consider the mobilization from Russian side and also participation from Russian side. This is probably one of the important directions for my research as well. That said, when we think about the scope, when we think about the visibility of this mobilization, when we think about the scope of also the scale of control and the nature of the relationship between the state and these actors, we can see that in Ukraine, it mainly relies on different forms of synergy, though there are also some conflicts sometimes. In Russia, still the mindset of control is the one who dominates these forms of participation. I think François mentioned vigilantism. So for instance, the state sports of vigilantism could be seen even during COVID-19 as some form of participation, when actually the state tries to take under control not only participation in wars, but also participation in any crisis response. Because starting from 2010, when there was many hundred thousands of people that participated in response to wildfires and floods, this is something that showed the state the power of independent forms of mobilization. It was not a political event, but it was political, because any form of large-scale independent mobilization highlights the lack of the state's capacity to address the crisis and creates some independent alternative structures of bottom-up mobilization. So from this point of view, that's where we could see the development of this vertical crowdsourcing mindset, that we need to offer some forms of participation, but these forms of participation need to take this participation under control, which also resonates with the idea of participatory authoritarianism as well. I think that we need to look more into the examples from Russian side, definitely, but I think still the structure of ecosystem from the Russian side is very different from the structure of ecosystem from the Ukrainian side.
Thank you very much, Timofey, for your question, and Gregory. Are there other questions either in the room or online? Otherwise, while you think about it a little bit more, I do have a couple of questions. So the first one actually concerns it kind of finishes up a triangle that Jeronimo started with participation and democracy, because when it comes to internet governance, actually there is a linked to participation, there is another adjective that comes often in the debate, and that is multi-stakeholder or multi-stakeholderism, with the idea that people will participate, multiple actors will participate with different tools tools and according to their respective goals in a particular process. So sometimes I was thinking while listening to you that there was some multi-stakeholder approach to war here and there in what you were describing. So I was wondering what you think about this, and if you think this perhaps you have also encountered this term used previously in what you read linked to this or in your fieldwork. And the second one is, so I was presenting a report about internet fragmentation this morning to the European Parliament, and a representative asked me a question. He asked me, in the current Russian-Ukraine conflict and in its digital implication, what can we do from the outside? And so I was musing about this while seeing your last slide in particular, and I was thinking, how can we identify the outside component of what you just described with respect to the inside and like the actual two opposite sides of the war labeled as this. If it is in any way methodologically or epistemologically useful to do that, to try and identify the other or the outside in these processes.
Thanks a lot. Two great questions. So first of all, I haven't seen the concept of multi-stakeholder warfare, so probably you can claim it now. I think this is a very interesting approach. And again, this resonates a lot with what we can see as a part of this ecosystem. What is interesting to mention also that in the context of the Ukraine political system, we can see a lot of dynamic transition of the members of elites from being volunteers and being citizens and activists to being a part of the political system. Because many of those people who participated in different forms of volunteer activities, actually the founder of the major crowdfunding project in 2014 now is the chief of staff for President Zelensky. So the crowdfunders came to power to some extent, and this is a very interesting reality because they came to power also with this horizontal mindset of mobilization and with this openness to innovation and with this understanding of digital tools. And obviously when you see this type of people with this type of mindset in power, that offers a very different forms of models of political management. So I think that partially can explain multi-stakeholderism, because also the stakeholders move fast from one square to another in the case of the Ukraine side. Now, regarding the boundaries, so if you rely on the concept of open innovation, so there is some kind of definition of boundaries that you can see in the management literature between the company and external environment. But I think that the boundaries is a part of the ongoing process of social and political construction as well. And this is something we had a presentation yesterday in discussion about the disconnected society, because disconnected society is mainly concerned with the management of the boundaries and the construction of boundaries based on different infrastructural aspects of what can be considered as a tools to create these boundaries. So definitely what is outside it was and what is inside is under continuous redesign based on in the context of different power relations that push these boundaries to different directions. So in response to this member, it's really challenging to address this question, because what is outside and what is inside. I think we are not here in the business of giving some advice, but I think that trying to support generally this type of systems that facilitate generativity and open innovation is something that contributes to civil resilience. We can see it in the case in Ukraine, and this lesson can be taken to other societies as well that can face different type of threats, not necessarily military threats, but also global catastrophic and existential threats, crisis situations. So this type of model can be applied not only to the war and military conflicts, but any type of global catastrophic risks and crisis situations.
Thank you. That's very helpful. And yeah, like the only example that really came to my mind to give him right away about like helping from the outside was like to fund Lantern, for example. Like, oh, let's fund an open system that is developed by a lot of Ukrainian developers as well. And I was really puzzled, and I thought that behind the question there was really a lot more and a lot of very complex musings to do about the other and the outside. Thank you so much. Are there other questions? Yes. Absolutely.
Can you say a word about Play for Ukraine? application because it really sounds like the war game movie, and so there is a kind of, there is a lot of ethical issues about it, and where could it be if it's enforced in the US, for example, or in our country, even in peacetime? And more generally, I have a question with the generative model. How could you draw a line between what is symbolic and what is material, and how it goes from one point to another?
Okay, let me start from the first question. It's also a challenging question, but it's less theoretical. So first of all, this case of Play for Ukraine is not actually the first case of the game that facilitated DDoS attacks. There was a platform in Russia, for instance, that was created about 15 years ago that was called Putin Zhrvayet Doma, which is in Russian, Putin explodes buildings, which is related to instances of mysterious terror attacks that took place in 1999, before Putin came to power. But the idea of this platform was that actually that you can pay to select some targets for attacks, and then the crowd is engaged, and then also there's some kind of vigilant aspect of this platform. And this platform was actively used during the Russia-Georgian war in 2008. So this simplification in hacktivist activities is an ongoing trend. This is not a new thing. And now from the legal point of view, obviously I'm not a legal person. There are many challenges, as I mentioned, particularly when this platform specifically mentioned that we are open for participation of children, that's what they say. You can understand that this the message within society under invasion, under attack, and where it comes from. But obviously, there are some ethical and legal consequences as well. I assume that it can be illegal in some countries, including the US. I'm not a legal expert, but I think that an interesting research question to consider. So I will not be able to give you the full response, but this is something that can be explored. And then you may ask actually if that's the end, if so verification of targets for artillery attacks can be also based on this type of games, what kind of offensive activities can be also gamified as well. And if you can think about the world of tanks, actually, which is linked to the offline reality when you do remote warfare with moving things. So the potential imaginaries of how gamified forms of participation can engage more people in offensive activities can go very far. So this is something that we need to think about, and it's a separate topic. Now, in relation to your second question about the link between symbolic and material, this is obviously a very philosophical question for me in the context of my specific framework, because I'm so I rely from the theoretical point of view, I haven't mentioned it, on cultural historical activity theory, which is one of the theories that introduced some specific notion of mediation and focused on mediation of activity. And based on this theory, the symbolic part is how the object of activity is constructed. So it's all things that are related to the construction of how you see the environment. And the material aspect is how you respond to the environment. So symbolic aspect is about the perception of reality or environment, because reality is a problematic world. And the material aspect is about the activities that you do as a form of your relationship with this environment. So this is a narrow response to the broad philosophical question within the specific theoretical framework that I rely on.
Great, thank you. Thank you very much. We might have time for one last question, if there is one, either in the room or on Zoom. Otherwise, I guess that we can bring this to a conclusion. With this, do you have a...
just want to say thank you for fascinating questions and for your attention. I would like to mention that it's still work in progress. And if any of you have any ideas for collaborations or any insights or any ideas for the how this type of research can be developed, I'm very open for any type of collaboration, and I am extremely privileged to have the opportunity to share this work in progress with you. Also to mention again that this is a part of my collaboration with my great colleague from Australia, Olga Boyshek. Hopefully, again, first of all, these are unfortunately very tragic events. And from the empirical point of view, I hope that we will not have more cases and this war will end in the way that it should end and the Russian aggression will stop. But I think we also have responsibility as scholars to try to engage critically with what's going on the field and try to think about what this means about the future as well. And that, as you mentioned, Francesca, it also has some policy implications as a part of your communication, for instance, with the members of parliament. So I think we have a great responsibility to think about these things in real time. And that's why I'm extremely thankful again for this opportunity to share it now. And hopefully it's going to be a start of our further dialogue. So thanks a lot for your attention. Thanks a lot for attending this talk. And please get in touch if you have any ideas, questions, insights.
Thank you so very much, Gregory. And indeed, as you mentioned, we kind of went through the same kind of dilemma when Xenia and I released our book last month about encryption with the Russia and Ukraine fieldwork. And we were like, we do hope that opportunities for new fieldwork in this regard stop as much as possible. In the meantime, let us do our job as scholars to bring this to the forefront and reflect on it. Thank you. Thank you so very much. I think that these 2 days in Paris have spread many ideas and opportunities for keeping the conversation going. And I wish to thank you very much for coming all the way to see us and to all the audience for being here for this last session of the year. And see you soon. Thank you very much. Bye.